Welcome to the Round Table, Episode 30. A program of current affairs, games, politics, and the arts. For the week ending the 17th of February. And now, Wayne K. Spear, Andrew Ferber, and Gregory Sean Pinch.
The 11th of February, 1963, 50 years ago this month, in EMI Studios, in a recording session, often described as a marathon, just under 10 hours in length, a small outfit known as the Beatles recorded their first album, Please Please Me. Mm-hmm. And I'm told it did pretty good. And they sold a few copies.
Yeah.
I think they even made some more. Here's a little taste of that. Recorded by producer George Martin with the four members of the Beatles in three sessions over the day. That was a Monday, as it was this year, the 11th. A groundbreaking album in several respects. Most of the songs on it were original compositions. That was unusual for the time. And the album was rushed to market in March, following the great success of the first single, Please Please Me. Recorded on two-track, one track for instruments and the other for vocals. What they did at the time was they just pretty much did their live show, recorded off the floor, which isn't really how albums are made now. You lay down track by track and it takes months.
Yeah.
A lot's changed. I had a
Or years if you're Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah. Guns N' Roses. And I had a book that it went through page by page every recording session that the Beatles ever did, and I actually read that thing. It covered all of their albums and described each track that they put down and how they did it and who engineered it and stories behind it. And this album, of course, was the first of many, and then by 1969 it was all over.
I think the fact they were able to lay it down so in such a short amount of time, I mean, speaks to how tight a band they were at that point, with all their gigging in Hamburg and whatnot. They do like three or four sets a day, and they were a tight band.
Well, that's the thing. They've been playing in Germany for years under what would be, by any standard, grueling circumstances, and they did get their chops down for sure. Another two things happened this week that were unrelated but seem to be related, an asteroid and a meteor. And to play a little clip about that.
This morning there are two stories in the news about large space rocks that have been flying close to Earth. One of them was about a meteor which exploded in the skies over Russia this morning. The other one was about an asteroid called 2012 DA14, which is passing very close to Earth today. It's not going to hit the Earth, but it is the largest object that's passed near Earth, and it's the closest an asteroid has passed near Earth since we've been watching the skies. In 1908, a rock of about the same size as this is believed to have crashed into a place called Tunguska in Siberia. The resulting explosion had the force of 1,000 Hiroshima bombs, so it's probably for the best that this rock today missed us. What you first see is the light of the meteor burning as it enters the atmosphere. At this stage, it's obviously traveling at tens of thousands of miles an hour, and what's causing it to burn is not friction with the air, but is instead that it's hitting the air so fast that the air can't get out of the way. The air is in front of it is being compressed incredibly and superheating. So the rock is then glowing red hot and burning, and that is what causes the light, the glowing red light as it comes through the sky. Eventually, enough of it burns away that it just loses all integrity and shatters and breaks apart, and that's what you see when the bright light, the sudden sort of looks like an explosion. While everyone's looking at the vapor trail left by the passing meteor in the air, there's an enormous boom which shakes the windows and breaks some windows. That's not the sound of the meteor exploding in the air. It's the sound of the sonic boom caused by a large object traveling incredibly fast through the atmosphere, sort of like the sonic boom made by Concorde. The reason the sonic boom hits you so much later is simply because the meteor broke entered the atmosphere so far away. Even when it breaks up, it's probably still 30 miles in the air or thereabouts. And like thunder and lightning, because light travels so much faster, the image reaches you a long time before the sound does.
Okay, so I was intrigued by this meteor which passed over a town in Russia, so I went on YouTube to look for, see if anybody had captured it on video. Yeah. Oh boy, had they. There were hundreds of these dashboard video camera. Right. So I started watching a few of them. I thought, boy, the Russians sure like to drive around with video cameras in their car on their dashboard. So I looked into it, and apparently, yeah, this is a big thing in Russia. People do put video cameras on their dashboard for a number of reasons, but one of them, it has to do with police corruption, yeah, apparently, which I had heard about. I heard, you know, you get pulled over and there's a bribe, or you have to, or anywhere, you'd be on a train or something and the police will stick you with some fine.
Highwaymen.
Yeah. So as a consequence of that, people are, they just make sure they catch everything on film. So anything that happens in Russia, you don't have to worry. You don't have to ever say, I wonder if anybody caught this on film. Apparently, it's impossible to do anything and not be caught on film. The Pope retired. Joseph Ratzinger, Benedict XVI. That hasn't happened in, I think, something like 600 years since the last Pope left willingly, left alive, left vertically. there's lots of talk about that and so on, and analysis, some speculation. One of the reasons he may have stepped down is to avoid some of these mounting cases that are being launched against him in relation to certain crimes within the church, which I think is euphemistically called abuses by priests. I did note that he has chosen to stay in Vatican City there, where he will be a Vatican citizen and will be still considered beyond the authority of any international tribunal or any other state that wishes to press charges. I found a Reuters report, actually, which this is something the church, or the Vatican particularly, the office has been diligent in investigating what their liabilities are and what best way to protect this Joseph Ratzinger fellow. There's been a few jurisdictions now where they've been trying to get some sort of case against him, including the International Criminal Court. Anyways, now speculation about who his successor is going to be, and all of the candidates seem to be in the same sort of mold, kind of the conservative faction, people who are take exception to Vatican II and would like to see the church return to a more traditionalist positions.
I thought the interesting, you said the other article about the speculation that the Pope will remain in the Vatican to have immunity from prosecution for child rape and the other stuff the Catholic Church gets up to. And it's I think it's interesting the way it illuminates the bizarre, I have to say bizarre, way that the Vatican is allowed, is actually like a member of the UN, and it's actually a state.
Yes.
And it has all those privileges of a state.
A state set up by the fascists.
Yes.
Party of Italy, Mussolini. Yeah. He made that very early on. The Catholic Church made two agreements. One was in Germany with Hitler, and the other one was in Italy with Mussolini. And the agreement with Germany was we'll cede you the political authority. Of course, there was the Catholic Center Party was the main alternative or opposition to the Germans and to the the Nazis, this National Socialist German Workers' Party. It was only with the decision of the center-right Catholic Party to join forces with the Nazis that they were finally able to take over in Germany. Mm-hmm. And the church made a Reichskonkordat with them that said, as long as we get to have our authority within the sphere of Catholic education right. and religion, you can have the political stuff. And then the deal in Italy was, we'll support you and we'll get to have our own little state sort of mm-hmm. within the state. And sweet deal.
Yeah.
That's how the Catholic Church did business.
Yeah. But isn't it crazy that that stands, that this deal with fascist Italy is recognized internationally?
But it's one of those having it both ways thing.
There is, absolutely. There is
the Catholic Church, the Vatican controls everything, and they're the boss. But when it comes to this, oh no.
That's right. They appoint the archbishops, the people that are complicit in and enable these child rapists to continue their foul acts. And they control the doctrine, which says that these guys have to live this chaste existence, and which is completely unreasonable and untenable, and then they step back and say, "Oh, we're not responsible for
it." Yeah, we have no idea who those people are.
That's a local problem for the local franchise.
Convenient. 1 Billion Rising, playwright Eve Ensler organizes Global Day of Dance Against Sexual Abuse. This was St. Valentine's Day, an international movement, dance movement to be specific. This saw thousands of women across the world, including countries like Afghanistan and India, raising their voice in support of women's rights. Got a little clip here. There's a couple people talking about that event.
More than 1 billion women are experiencing abuse, and we women cannot just let it pass. That is why we want this day to mark an end to violence against women.
Pee Wee Herman's Twitter feed here. This was a tweet from this week. Not on cruise ship in Russia or being asked questions by Elizabeth Warren. TGIF. Yeah, those were... did you hear about that cruise ship? Of course you did.
Yeah, a little bit.
There's a huge article here that I found in the Associated Press. It goes on and on and on. I mean, it's pretty simple.
I didn't get through it. The whole thing.
Neither did I.
I got the gist of it.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty simple. So this cruise ship, there's a fire in the engine room and they run out of electricity and have to go up on backup power, so they've got no water and toilets aren't working, and it's 5 days.
They're out of booze.
Out of booze. That yes, it was. There were some tragic elements to it.
I just made up that part.
Oh dear.
Ooh. That would have been complete mutiny.
Yeah, you had me there for a second.
Woo. You got no toilets, you need booze. That's for sure.
Yeah, so that was the first part of that Pee Wee Herman was referring to. And of course, in Russia, we talked about that. We've got all this here in the show. It's a full package deal here. The meteor. But the third one, this was great. Elizabeth Warren. So everybody should know about this. I saw a post, and he links to this, Paul Rubens does. Mm-hmm. Upworthy, this isn't a website I'd ever heard of before, but it's kind of handy. Got some good stuff on there. Upworthy.com. And the headline here is, Elizabeth Warren asks the most obvious question ever and stumps a bunch of bank regulators. So if you don't know, Elizabeth Warren is a freshman senator from the fine state of Massachusetts. And the good people of that state elected her, presumably because of her very strong stance against Wall Street bankers and financiers and all of those other con artists, those pyramid scamists out there who are doing such wonderful damage to the economy and to ordinary people. Well, I'll define ordinary people as people who are not Wall Street bankers in this case, who aren't making a living by screwing people over. So Elizabeth Warren goes into a committee. She's on the Senate Banking Committee. Goes into a hearing and asks the question, have any of you fellows, mostly the fellows, women fellows, regulators who are charged with keeping the banks, keeping the Wall Street honest, what kind of a job are you doing here? Have you taken any of these guys to court?
When was the last time you prosecuted, you took to trial any of these banksters?
Yeah, and here's, I'll play the clip. You'll hear her ask the question and you'll hear the eloquent responses.
Evasions,
yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the last few times you've taken the biggest financial institutions on Wall Street all the way to a trial. Anybody? Chairman Curry?
To offer my perspective.
Sure.
A bank supervisor. We primarily view the tools that we have as mechanisms for correcting deficiencies. So the primary motive for our enforcement actions is really to identify the problem and then demand a solution to it on an ongoing basis.
That's right. And then you set a price for that. Sorry to interrupt, but I just want to move this along. That's effectively a settlement. And what I'm asking is, when did you last take, and I know you haven't been there forever, so I'm really asking about the OCC, a large financial institution, a Wall Street bank, to trial?
The institutions I supervise, national banks and federal thrifts, we've actually had a fair number of consent orders. We do not have to bring people to a trial or an
Well, I appreciate that you say you don't have to bring them to trial. My question is, when did you bring them to trial?
We have not had to do it as a practical matter to achieve our supervisory goals.
Ms. Walter?
Thank you, Senator. As you know, among our remedies are penalties, but the penalties we can get are limited, and we actually have asked for additional authority, my predecessor did, to raise penalties. When we look at these issues, and we truly believe that we have a very vigorous enforcement program, we look at the distinction between what we could get if we go to trial and what we could get if we don't.
I appreciate that. That's what everybody does. And so the question I'm really asking is, can you identify when you last took the Wall Street banks to trial?
I will have to get back to you with the specific information, but we do litigate, and we do have settlements that are either rejected by the commission or not put forward for
approval. Okay, we've got multiple people here. Anyone else want to tell me about the last time you took a Wall Street bank to trial? You know, I just want to note on this. There are district attorneys and U.S. attorneys who are out there every day squeezing ordinary citizens on sometimes very thin grounds and taking them to trial in order to make an example, as they put it. I'm really concerned that too big to fail has become too big for trial. That just seems wrong to me.
Yeah, I'll get back to you on that.
Yeah, I watched the video for this. I thought what was interesting, it's quite obvious the demeanor of the people being asked the questions here, and they're definitely not used to this type of scrutiny and don't appreciate it for sure, especially the first guy, the OCC, what was it, OCC, the first guy?
Yeah.
He was just so uncomfortable, like he was not used to this.
It's like the government is actually against me. Yeah. Well, as I always like to remind people, the top funders for Barack Obama's, it certainly his first election campaign. I haven't looked at the numbers for the second one, but there's a lot of Wall Street people
definitely
on that list.
Yeah. So. Well, they play both sides.
Yeah, exactly.
Pepsi and Coke.
Ban on rum named after porn star Ron Jeremy. Just another day for Canada's hyper-strict liquor laws. Tristan Hopper writing for the National Post. In a potent reminder of the arbitrary censorial powers of Canadian liquor authorities, a rum cheekily named for pornographic actor Ron Jeremy was pulled from Manitoba store shelves after customers complained it was obscene. Dubbed Ron to Jeremy, the liquor's label features an image of Ron Jeremy's face above the taglines, the adult liquor.
Long, smooth taste.
And long, like smooth taste, yeah. As opposed to the childhood liquor, which they, I'm pretty sure the LCBO wouldn't let that picture kitty on liquor. The childhood liquor, the kitty liquor. This is a Finnish product from Finland. And I'm sure they were completely unprepared. Maybe they weren't, but I've spoken to people who've tried to go through these LCBO hoops. And yeah, they say there's all kinds of rules, all kinds of, I guess they're prohibition era stuff. Go down, give a list of examples of things which didn't quite get through the censors at the liquor board, the local provincial liquor authorities. Quebec refused to grant a license to a suburban Montreal bar unless they refused to play rap or hip-hop music. Remember that one? They cite one here in Vancouver where a theater was prohibited from showing movies, which is a bit awkward if you're a movie theater. It doesn't work. TV, you can't show anyone consuming the product which they're trying to sell. And there's all kinds of this. I remember talking to a guy who was a brewer, and he said they had one product and it had a gun on the label. Mm-hmm. So that was out. They couldn't have that. And they actually, I saw down here, Flying Monkey was also, they ran into some trouble there. They had, that's a great beer. Flying Monkey stuff, their pale ale. But they got into some trouble too and had to do some redesigning of one of their labels. Well, there's all kinds of this stuff.
I liked the Crystal Head vodka with the skull-shaped bottle.
Oh, Dan
what's
Aykroyd.
More appropriate for a bottle of booze than a skull?
Exactly. And then they were refusing to sell a craft beer named Smash Bomb Atomic IPA. That's too extreme. Mm-hmm. Somebody might actually get the idea to use it as a bomb, maybe. I don't know. Meth, actually not that bad for you, report doctors. Dismantling stereo. This is an Onion article we're going to throw in here.
That's important.
Yeah, we don't report enough on what's going on at the Onion. Other agencies around the world will sometimes report the Onion, and not even realizing it's satire. I'll read a bit of this. Challenging a growing scientific consensus over the dangers of methamphetamines, a team of doctors frantically prying apart and dismantling a stereo system released the findings of a new study Friday, concluding that the synthetic drug actually isn't really that bad for you. Speaking from a filthy, trash-littered basement in an abandoned building near Boston's Mount Auburn Hospital, the group of pallid physicians told reporters their research provides striking evidence that the psychostimulant has been erroneously classified by the medical community as a dangerous substance, when in fact it has few discernible downsides. So it says, the article goes on to say that they were ripping wires out of a stereo receiver and inspecting it for hidden surveillance devices. Here's a quote. According to our own studies, meth is fine for you, completely fine. lead researcher Dr. Meredith Walters said in an agreement with several dirty, disheveled physicians disassembling the circuit breakers in an amplifier box. So you heard it here first.
Yeah.
Aboriginal Affairs Minister John Duncan resigns from cabinet. This came out. Oh, I know.
Damn it.
This was reported by CBC on Friday. So the reports here I'm seeing say that he resigned over a letter which showed he was contacting a tax court judge on behalf of a constituent in Vancouver. Actually, I think it was Vancouver Island. That's his seat there, the Vancouver Island riding. So he stepped down because of this letter not too long ago. Was it Flaherty, right? The finance minister. He also intervened for a constituent on behalf of a CRTC ruling, and he got into trouble for that. So the government undertook an investigation internally to see if there were any more of these cases, started looking through correspondence, and John Duncan was another person who had I guess illegally or unethically or whatever the term is. Not supposed to do that.
Yeah.
Not supposed to get involved in court rulings or so on for on behalf of constituents. So He has now stepped down, and some speculation about whether this will lead to a cabinet shuffle beyond just filling that vacancy.
Yeah, I find this really odd, this story. That's part of an MP's, that's what they do on a day-to-day basis. They intervene on immigration matters and whatnot. This is not actually a criminal case either. This is like a tax court or something.
Well, and there's some speculation that there may have been more going on.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at with this whole... I mean, you know, Flaherty's okay. This guy's... No, he's got to go.
He's on many people's short list of deadbeat members of Parliament, but not at the Congress of Aboriginal Peoples. So I'll quote National Chief Betty Ann Valley here, who said, "Over a number of years, I've gotten to know Mr. Duncan quite well. He is an honorable man who is doing his best to improve the lives of all Aboriginal peoples throughout Canada. His contributions in moving the Aboriginal agenda forward will not be forgotten." Well, actually, you can read that in a couple of ways. I guess he was probably was doing his best. And he probably won't be forgotten.
He was trying.
Yeah, he was doing everything in his limited powers. the Congress of Aboriginal People, of course, was the former place of occupation of a certain senator who we mentioned last week. As I explained in that show, I tried to explain that the Congress of Aboriginal People have had especially warm relations with this government, with the Conservative Party of Canada. Mm-hmm. So I'm not surprised to see the national chief there trying to come out as positively as humanly possible.
Yes.
Susan Root has sung "How Much Is That Doggy in the Window" stuck in her head for 3 years.
How much is that dog?
That wouldn't be annoying at all.
I think it's mentioned in Dante's Inferno as one of the levels of hell.
What, Patty Page?
this former tenant.
Oh, having a song stuck in your head? Yeah.
Or should be.
I wonder what song that would have been back in the 13th century. Sumer is a Kuminin. Ludi sing cuckoo. So according to this article here, it says, this is the Telegraph, by the way, 63-year-old British woman Susan Root has had the 1950s classic "How Much Is That Doggy in the Window" stuck in her head for 3 years with no end in sight. She's been diagnosed with a form of tinnitus that a spokesman for the British Tinnitus Association called musical hallucinations, more commonly referred to as earworms. It's like having a radio that you can't turn off, Root said. I began hearing tunes in my ears 3 years ago, and it just has not stopped since. She's also apparently been tortured by songs including "God Save the Queen."
The Sex Pistols version?
That's a good question. I don't know. "Happy Birthday"? Really? "An Auld Lang Syne." Yeah, that would be annoying.
Well, the "Happy Birthday" would be appropriate one day a year.
Yeah.
As with the "Auld Lang Syne." "Auld Lang Syne."
Yeah, exactly. You get stuck in your head that one day. You know the lyrics.
Yeah. And the Queen's birthday, I guess, for God Save the Queen.
But how do we know she's really... not making this up.
I don't think you'd make up something like this.
Well, I don't know. You want to get in the papers?
Yeah, I guess we're safe.
You could just say, I've been smelling burnt toast for 3 years.
I do feel sorry for it.
Yeah, that's pretty awful. But I just played this so maybe it can stick in our listeners' heads. Well, another show, Andy.
Yes.
And with any luck, we'll all be together here next week, see what kind of foolishness and madness and insanity ensues over the next few days. And we'll see you back here at lovely High Park near the center of the universe. Take care. Be good. My
Does it feel like you?